We think we are pretty smart. After all, we have stepped on the moon. But somewhere along the line, we forgot how to eat and learned how to poison ourselves instead. So we ask, how can we relearn how not to poison ourselves?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1169th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Urubamba who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, we the people think we are pretty clever, right? And not only clever, but in total control of pretty much everything that happens for good or evil here on Mother Earth. But if you look around a little, you can see a lot of evidence that we have lost just about all control over what we eat. And in fact, a lot of what we have learned about this, what we eat is pretty much poisoning ourselves to death. And we have very little control over this poisoning. Listen to how Professor Emeritus Fred Provenza describes it in his new book, Nourishment. Forget willpower. It isn't effective for changing your behavior. Forget reading labels. If the food product has a label, the creation probably isn't any good for you. Don't bring toxic junk food into your home. You don't have any willpower to avoid it. Forget diets. They don't work. Well, given how bad we have become with feeding ourselves, perhaps we should back up a bit and look to animals and to see what they can teach us about eating. And who better to guide us than Fred Provenza, who is a professor emeritus of wildland resources at Utah State and author of Nourishment, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom. Fred, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Michael, nice to be back with you again. Thank you for having me.
You bet. So back from number 651 to Food Chain number 1169, that's 418 weeks ago we last talked. And I remember that conversation very well because you're up in my kind of country, up in the Intermountain West, and you're talking a lot about animals and grazing and what you learn from them and whatnot. And you know, usually, Fred, I ask for what epiphany, you know, my guest had that led them to the story on the table for the day. But in this case, I don't think it's an epiphany, really, but really the work of a, you know, the culmination of the collected wisdom of your entire career. This book is incredible.
Well, Michael, thank you for the kind words. I'm glad you liked it. It was, I wrote the book, as you know, after I retired from Utah State University. My wife and I moved to what I refer to as the backwoods of Colorado, which literally we were living 12 miles on graveled roads off of the top of a place called Trout Creek Pass. So we were in the backwoods, and it was just a great setting to reflect really kind of on the mysteries and wonders of life, on the abilities of all kinds of wild animals were living up there, and the beautiful plants and the animals, and just a chance to sit back and reflect on on the visit to this planet, actually, and then of course foraging but as you know, the book is quite reflective in that sense. And then it was also a chance during those years to think about and to try to immerse myself in the scientific literature on humans. You know, as you mentioned, right, we'd spent 35, 40 years studying domestic and wild animal species. You know, what?
Well, okay, Fred, now the big question to you, what's the difference between humans and animals?
You know, I think on many levels we're so similar, Michael, the parallels are stunning. I think probably one of the biggest differences that strikes me has to do with culture, and not that they don't have cultures. They certainly do. You know, they live in extended families, and they have cultures that link them to the foods they select and the habitats they select. But I think culture for humans can be either a huge enabler of both our physical and spiritual well-being, or it can really be a strangulating kind of influence. And, you know, you can see both things, but I think nowadays, and in the book, I talked often about what would be more the strangulating kind of influences and how they really... They work to our detriment, huh? They work to our detriment.
Well, you know, and in that regard, you know, I was going through nourishment and thinking I could talk about this and I could talk about that and I could talk about this. And then I ran into a chapter that just really bowled me over, which is how to poison a rat, cow, or human. And so I think that's a good place for us to start this. How do you poison? What makes for a good poison? There's two things you talk about that make for a good poison. What's number one?
Right. Let me step back just a tad, and I'll come to the two things and tell you why that struck me. You know, it's rare that wild animals get poisoned on plants.
Okay.
And even domestic animals, it's fairly rare occurrence that they get poisoned. And so the question is, well, what are the conditions that set them up to be poisoned? And that leads us to the two questions.
Good.
And to this idea, you know, if you wanted to poison a creature, how would you go about doing that? And there, the two things are, first, you have to get by their bullshit detector, so to speak. And that's their sense of taste and smell and anything that's different. Animals are incredibly cautious of anything that's different. We showed that over and over again. Take a familiar food, add just a little bit of some unfamiliar flavor, they don't want to eat it. They're very, very cautious. So you have to do that first. You have to figure, how do you make something that you want to poison an animal on seem familiar, even though now it's going to be toxic? That's the first part.
You've got to sneak it by
the Trojan horse, huh? Right. You've got to put the Trojan horse in there. And, you know, it's not a trivial deal. It's amazing over the years, and I won't take our time to share stories with you, but I have no end of stories of how when you put something different in a food, how cautious they become. It's not that they'll totally avoid it from then on, but they eat very small amounts and gradually increase. They're really testing whether or not this food is toxic. So you've got to get by. You've got to get by that first. The second thing that goes with it, and that's really useful, is, you know, when they're sampling small amounts of something, or if you're trying to trick them, you want them to have a very positive response at first, a very positive kind of experience with the food, and so. One of the ways that it happens in nature, as well as in the human food system, which I know we'll get to, is to follow that with nutrients, with a blast of energy and protein, nutrients that are really reinforcing. And that combination is can set up what I refer to in the book as feedback trap. So how does it work? Okay, I started out that chapter talking about this beautiful, beautiful plant called local weed, that in the spring of the year in those backwoods of Colorado, you'd have the beautiful green aspen leaves and trees scattered about, and local would just cover like a carpet of snow almost the ground. It's very, very nutritious at that time of the year, and it's one of the first plants to come out. And that's a deadly combination for livestock, especially livestock that are naive to those environments, that aren't really familiar with being there. For instance, stalker cattle that people would bring from all over the U.S. and put them in those environments. Well, what happens is, here's this really attractive plant. It's one of the main items, so they eat a little bit of it. Wham, blast of energy and protein. It's really nutritious plant. So you eat a little bit more and you eat a little bit more, and pretty soon it's a part of your diet. But the problem is that the effect of these alkaloids that are in this local weed plant don't occur for several days or weeks afterwards. The deadly effects are delayed in time. And so by the time the animal is actually experiencing the potentially life-threatening effects, they aren't even associating it with the food because the food has snuck in like a Trojan horse below the radar screen. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's a perfect poison. It sneaks past the defenses, and it's nutritious so that you keep eating it and keep eating it. And then it keeps compiling itself in your system, and pretty soon, you're loco.
Right, you're loco. You're loco. And
there you
know,
go.
And
we're going to have to take a quick break, Fred. But when we come back, I would like to take this story and take it to the story of the gentleman who went to Alaska to escape civilization, how Chris McCandless died. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Fred Provenza, and you do stay tuned. We will be right back after these messages.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
The perfect poison. It has to get past the defenses. It has to offer that benefit. Have to be nutritious. Have to give you something so that you come back and keep eating it. And it has to be a delayed action so you don't recognize it right away that you're in trouble. Now, you brought up the story that John Krakauer wrote about and how Chris McCandless died. And he, of course, was a young man that went out into the backcountry of Alaska, determined to escape civilization, and did, but the wrong way. What happened there?
Well, I think several things set Chris up for the eventual downfall, Michael. And at the broadest scale, I think, you know, I admire and understand why he wanted to escape, you know, go up there into the backwoods of Alaska.
As you did, right?
Right. So I can totally, and it's not for everybody, but I can relate. But, you know, culture is a huge, huge deal. Over and over again, we saw that with domestic animals. When we break cultural links to landscape, that sets them up for poisoning.
That's like the stalker cattle, right?
Just like the stalker cattle. They have, you know, they have no knowledge of those landscapes. They have no social models to learn from. And Chris was in a similar situation. You know, he's out there on his own trying to figure all this stuff out. And sure, you know, he may have had books with him and so forth, but that's not the same thing as learning from
eating.
You know, in a cultural situation, yeah, you're learning from mother what and what not to eat. It starts even in the womb, of course, as the flavors of foods that mom eats get into her amniotic fluid. And so, and then after that, in her milk when you're born, and then using her as a model. So he had none of that kind of background. He literally was on his own and sampling all these different plants, and the risks go way up when you do that. And then he ended up with one of the plants there that he referred to as potato, if I'm recalling correctly, that was really analogous in my mind to the loco weed. You know, it's a nutritious plant, and it has delayed kind of effects. I know people were debating quite a lot, you know, well, what was the toxin in that plant and so forth. And for our purposes, whether they've identified exactly what it was or not is not so much the point. It's that the immediate consequences of eating those potatoes were highly reinforcing nutrients in the gut. The delayed effects occurred down the road, and so it was another perfect kind of feedback trap that poor Chris fell into.
And so describe the feedback trap one more time here. It seems like we have, you know, your analogy of the stalker feed cattle who are brought in from all over everywhere and dumped into the meadows of the mountains. Say, here, cows, eat this and thrive. And they eat that wonderful young loco weed, and it's delicious, and it gives them energy, and they feel good. But the poison builds up in their system. And the same thing happened with Chris McCandless. He found a food that gave him energy, But it built up in his system, and pretty soon he was gone.
Right, and you've just perfectly described the feedback trap. Really, it's immediate positive consequences, delayed aversive consequences. And if you think beyond just food to the many ways that we get into feedback traps, credit card debt, immediate positive consequences, delayed aversive kind of consequences, climate change, immediate positive consequences, delayed negative consequences. You know, it's always these things that have an immediate positive effect and delayed in time or distant in space kind of negative effect. And those are feedback traps, and they're common in nature, and human beings certainly are confronted with those all the time. And then the question is, you know, life is fraught with uncertainty, right? I mean, that's a huge point that the book gets into, is that you never know what's going to happen. We can't. And science really can't help us with that either. You know, science is good at some things, help us to understand principles and processes. But in the end, science can't predict any better than anything else. And we talk about probabilities and likelihoods, but not certainties. And so life is fraught with uncertainty, and that creates then the endless kind of debates that we get into. Sure. Over, well, what's going to happen in the future, and what do you do, and you know, and with climate change, we're certainly in the middle of all that nowadays, huh? And well, you have people on both sides, even though the scientists, and I'm with them. I'm totally thinking we better be doing everything we can to deal with that. Anyway, keep it going.
Okay. Well, okay. We do have our defenses, though, innate defenses, do we not? We have what you call gut and skin defenses. Tell us a little bit about our defenses.
Yes. Well, we do have these inborn ways that from a skin defense standpoint evolved to protect us and all creatures from predators. And you use the senses of sight and smell and so forth to be on guard in the environment against potential predators.
So those are like outside defense mechanisms, right?
Outside the body. That's right. Anything that might attack you from the outside. And then the skin defenses are the gut defenses, I'm sorry, are, you know, what's inside the body, and how the different organ systems of the body are designed to detect nutrients from a positive standpoint, and then to detect toxins from a negative standpoint, and to alert us so that we ingest what we need to and avoid what's toxic for us. And so those two defenses are a 1-2 that, and I think one of the most important thing about both those systems, Michael, we say that they're innate, they're built into the body, and that's certainly the case, but the way that they work is entirely plastic. They're built on learning. And that's one of the things that, you know, people, when we started our work years ago, they thought animals are more like machines, you know, they're all machine-like. But what we showed over and over again, they're constantly learning about their environment. And it's the only way to survive. When you think, you know, a species is, when it comes into existence on this planet, it lives around, 10 million years, people say, is the average lifetime. Just think of the tremendous amount of changes that this Earth undergoes in 10 million years. The only way that creatures survive is to be able to learn, learn.
Always change. Always change. I sometimes think of the Earth as really just like a soap bubble in space. You know, when you look at a soap bubble that a child blows into the air, you just see the surface swirling around, and it's always changing. And I guess that's what you're saying. Got to be on the change to make this work.
So, right, you know, and we're confronted with that. It never ends. I think a lot of times we live under the illusion that, well, we'll finally figure the cure for cancer or the cure for bacteria, or, you know, all the wars that we fight, all the war, everything that's a huge issue becomes, you know, we're going to declare war on it. But what's become clear to me, at least, the way I look at it, is it never ends. It's part of being on this planet. So you either continually change and adapt and transform, or you go out, you know, as an individual, as a social group, or as a species, you know. And paleontologists tell us 99.99% of the species that have ever been here are gone now, so eventually it catches up with you, huh?
So, and,
yeah,
perhaps that's been mankind's greatest ability, was the ability to adapt. But there's one thing we've had a significant amount of trouble adapting to, and that, I think, is the food in the supermarket. And so when we come back from this break, Fred, I'd like you to take us to what it's like to, for us to be foraging around in the supermarket, and how those poisons sneak past our defenses. This is the Food Chain, right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, we've been talking about how to poison ourselves and animals and everything else, and it's a trick we've learned through the years. We're doing a very good job of it. To have a good poison, it must be able to sneak past our defenses, and it must be able to give us something we really like, so we keep coming back for it. It has to also have that delayed effect, right? It can't kill you right away. You have to keep coming back for it. So let's take that notion and go along with Fred Provenza, author of Nourishment, What Animals Can Teach Us About Remembering What We Should Be Eating, and then go for a shopping trip to the supermarket. Fred, what are we going to find to eat in the supermarket that can sneak past our defenses?
Well, Michael, I've read that there's something like 600,000 items in the modern supermarkets. I've never tried to count them, but there's certainly a huge array of different things, all very attractively displayed on the shelves, and all, you know, so many of them are really a perfect combination of what we've been talking about. You know, immediate, very positive kind of reinforcement. Typically with a good blast of energy from refined carbohydrates on the processed foods.
Zoom!
And, yeah, and so we love them, you know, and I love them. Everybody, you know, they're very, very desirable kinds of things.
They're like the loco weed in the spring, right?
Right, they're like the local weed in the spring. For this, and really, we're kind of stalker cattle in that sense. You know, we're put into this unfamiliar environment, but think about how that's done too. Many of those foods have familiar kinds of flavors, right? We got to get below the radar screen. So fruit flavors or spice flavors, they're artificial flavors. They're not really the real thing at all, but so that's, you know, that gets below our detectors, right? They're familiar. You take a familiar flavor and then you pair it with a blast of energy and, you know, it's hard to resist that. Then in the case of sugar, it's debated, but there's pretty good evidence, which I review in Nourishment, that sugar is addicting, is actually addicting. So you really, and some of the compounds in these plants we talked about for the animals actually have addicting kind of qualities in that same sense. So we really get set up for problems.
So it's kind of feedback trap that the stalker feeder cattle fall into with respect to the loco weed. It's winter, spring comes, the loco weed pops out. Oh my goodness, it tastes so good! Immediate source of energy, away I go, and yet that loco weed has chemicals in it that build up over time. Pretty soon, you've got loco cows. Now, same thing happened to us in the supermarket?
Yeah, basically the same thing. Just get so hooked on those particular foods. And I think one of the things I think about a lot anymore, Michael, too, and, you know, so you've got that. You've got all the processed foods. But then, and then, you know, people talk, well, don't shop the main aisle, shop on the outside. Shop where the fruits and vegetables are, basically, you know, and get the meats and so forth. But, you know, in a way, we've really shot ourselves in the foot on that, too. And I think it's for several reasons. We've the way that we grow foods, and I'm not trying to be the big critic or the big know-it-all or anything else, but just reflecting, and this comes from really cool studies in ecology. Ecologists have been studying this stuff for 40, 50 years, what I'm going to talk about next. But that is the way that we grow, the way that we grow the foods that we grow, the fruits and vegetables. When we add water, when we irrigate, and then when we fertilize those things, we increase growth at the expense of what I refer to as phytochemical richness. Mm-hmm. And that's this whole suite of not energy, protein, minerals, and vitamins, but all these thousands of compounds that plants produce that we've come to realize are so important for the health and survival of plants, and that we're coming to realize are absolutely fundamentally important for the health and nutrition of wild animals, domestic animals, human beings as well. They counter all the hallmarks of cancer. They're healthy for your heart. They help with diabetes, blah, blah, blah. They go on. It's amazing, these phytochemicals that are in plants, what I refer to as phytochemicals.
So you're kind of talking about the same thing. It's easy, so let's do it. And it is easy, right? Up front, right?
Right, right. And so you know, by the ways that we grow these foods, the fruits and vegetables, we select, but we enhance growth at the expense of this phytochemical richness. The varieties we've selected for over the years, and this is both with pasture plants that we feed to livestock, as well as fruits and vegetables in the stores. We selected for varieties that have more rapid kind of growth rates, and we've selected against phytochemical richness in these plants. You know, I was out in your part of the country several years ago working with some people where we were showing them ways to train sheep to avoid eating fruit trees in their fruit orchards. And we've done that in vineyards and so forth as well. But I'll never forget this one fellow said, okay, you know, here's what's happened in the fruit industry over time. And he was explaining the kind of changes I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, you know, I'm going to show you something. He said, this is the fruit we sell to you. This is the fruit you guys eat, but I'm going to show you the fruit we eat. And he took us back to the back of his orchard, and he was showing us these old varieties of trees. And he said, taste this. And the phytochemical richness blew your socks off. You know, it wasn't just sweet. It had just robust, pungent, beautiful kind of flavor. And my wife, we're living in Montana now, and when you go for hikes in the late summer or the fall of the year, you'll encounter maybe at least 10 different wild plant species that all have fruits on them, whether they're choke cherries or buffalo berries or service berries or whatever. And when you eat those, there's a richness of flavor that just gets you. And those phytochemicals are what's doing that. But here's I'm going to wind it back now to the processed foods. If you're making a processed food, what you want people to do is to eat more, more, more of that, right? You want intake to go up. The more people eat, the better. So it's all basically the same kind of not-so-nutritious stuff, blast of energy, but put it in different flavors. Put it in a variety of different flavors so that you keep those taste buds stimulated. Well, what plants do, and this is old thinking in ecology, but it's so powerful. I think about it all the time anymore. Those secondary compounds in all those wild plants set a limit on how much of any one plant an animal can eat.
Hold that thought, Fred, because we're going to have to take a break in just a moment. But this is such a significant part of how to get back to where we need to be. And it's so important for people to understand this. So going to pick it up when we come back from this break. How do we get back to learn how to eat right instead of poisoning ourselves, which is exactly what we do when we go to the supermarket and buy all of those pretty packages with all of that sweetness and all of those wonderful tastes. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Fred Provenza and you. How do we get back to eating right? Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back, and we have we're chewing on something that's so incredibly important to getting back to eating right, to eating for nourishment. And that is what we find in the food that's being offered to us. So much of what is being offered, artificial flavors, lots of sugar in various forms. Zoom! It tastes good, but we'd never lose our hunger. Why do we never lose our hunger, Fred?
Well, Michael, as we were starting to launch into there, wild plants all contain these secondary compounds or phytochemicals, as we were saying, that are so important for the health of the plant, our health as well. And these compounds set a limit on how much of any one plant and animal can eat. And that becomes absolutely fundamental to understanding how to get back to what we need to do. So what do animals do then? We need to eat more energy than anything else during the day. That's the nutrient we need in the greatest amount. So how do animals get the energy they need when these compounds are setting a limit on how much of any one food they can eat? They do it by eating a variety of different species that contain different kinds of these secondary compounds. And so maybe they'll eat so much of trefoil that has tannin, and so much of alfalfa that has saponins, and so much of tall fescue that has alkaloids, and on and on and on and on. What that does is it doesn't swamp then detoxification mechanisms, because they're really good at limiting how much they eat, and it exposes bodies then to this huge array of these secondary compounds that are so healthful for cells. That's, you know, at the cellular level, and that's, we haven't talked much about this feedback part of things, but, you know, cells and organ systems, including the microbiome, feedback through hormones, neurotransmitters, a whole bunch of ways to influence our liking for foods. And that whole system then works together so nicely, but what's key is that those compounds set limits. They put the brakes on. What we've done with processed food is to remove the brakes and put the accelerator to the floor. So, you know, what we've done, and, you know, fruits and vegetables in the store still have these compounds in them, which are going to set limits. But the fact that we've selected against phytochemical richness, where we've let quantity trump quality and richness, I think shoots us in the foot on a bunch of these varieties. And so I think it's really important that we try to understand which varieties of foods in the grocery store, of vegetables as well as fruits, have the highest concentrations of these compounds. If we, like my wife and I, you like to grow your own fruits and vegetables, trying to identify what kind of heirloom varieties or older varieties, which ones are the most phytochemically rich. A lady named Jo Robinson wrote a book on a few years back. You've probably talked to Jo.
I certainly have.
Right. Well, you know, that's what she's getting at in all of that, is how to identify the plants that are most phytochemically rich. That's so important. Same thing for the meats that we eat. You know, you can match right down the line what we've done with fruits and vegetables with what we're doing with animals. And it's not just livestock like cattle, sheep, and goats. It certainly is, but boy, the poultry and some of those, they're just grown for very, very, very rapid growth. And so we're really diluting nutrients at the expense of growth in them as well. Far better off to grow your own or to source from people who let their animals get some age on them. You know, I've read and talked to people that, you know, an animal, it's the older they get, the more compounds they get in their body, basically. And in nourishment, I talk about that, about the fact that when animals that we eat are eating phytochemically rich diets, eating a huge array of different plant species, those compounds get into their meat and fat. And so when we eat them, we get those compounds into our bodies as well. On the other hand, if animals are fed a grain diet and very quickly taken to their market weight, that richness, that biochemical richness, is lacking in them as well. And so, you know, it's not just the plants we eat, it's the animals we eat as well. And you can match those same things up, you know, from the variety, so to speak, to plucking them when they're ripe, as opposed to you know, when they're green, picked green and fed.
After doing, you know, over 1,100 of these shows, I came to the conclusion that some things hold true always. So I came up with Michael Olson's laws of the food chain, and I was going to tag this show under the second law, which is the farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over your food. But I think it fits better into the third law of the food chain, which is cheap food isn't. Because you always talk about how cheap things are more expensive. It seems easier. It seems cheaper. It seems better. But it always ends up being more expensive. Am I wrong?
Oh, absolutely right, Michael. And it's the feedback trap again.
The feedback trap, yeah.
It's the feedback trap again.
Well, we're going to have to take...
Low cost now.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to ask you how we escape the feedback trap. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Fred Provenza and you right back. So much to talk about.
So much to say, so little time to say it on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
It is true. We have so much to talk about, so little time to talk about it in with Fred Provenza, author of Nourishment. Do yourself a favor. If you got into this program late, logged in late, find it on the Food Chain Archives at metrofarm.com. Better yet, go pick up a copy of Nourishment by Fred Provenza, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom. So, Fred, how do we escape this feedback trap that has us trapped into poisoning ourselves?
I think, Michael, that it's simple to say what I'm going to say next, but, you know, when you're in the trap, it's maybe not so easy to do. But I think the key is to surround ourselves with wholesome foods, and that's going to take some homework, I think, a lot of the time, to figure out, you know, when you're in the grocery store and you're selecting fruits and vegetables, you know, well, which ones are the most nutritious of those. When you're trying to decide what, if you eat meat, which meats and which fishes as well. Same thing for fishes.
Mm-hmm. Same thing for everything, right?
For everything, right. They're trying to get to wholesome foods. And, you know, I'll be honest, my wife and I aren't like, we never touch a refined carbohydrate. I'd be lying to you if we do, but we keep it in moderation. You know, we keep it in moderation. But I think when a person gets addicted to that stuff, it's impossible to keep it in moderation. I work with a medical doctor here. Actually, he worked for me when I was at Utah State University 40 years ago. He worked as part of our program. Then he went into medical school. Well, now he so practices all the things that we're talking about. And he says, you know, when patients come to me with their various ailments, he says, look, the first thing we've got to get right is your diet. Then we'll talk about whether or not you've even got any issues. Because most cases, the issues go away when we get your diet right. And get your diet right means getting you off of all of the refined carbohydrates that have come to so dominate. You know, I'm not a... I don't feel that they're the devil, that refined carbs are just the devil. It's the amounts we eat them in that's the problem.
That's the devil, right.
They've taken over. So when you're there and then you're pre-diabetic or diabetic and you've got issues with metabolic syndrome, then you're really in trouble. And that's this medical doctor deals a lot with folks like that. So then, you know, what do? He really works hard to get them totally to avoid those foods and to get on to wholesome foods related to the vegetables that you're eating and the meats, you know. And the meats, we here where we live in Montana, all of us, there are so many, and that's getting to be common. There's so many people that you can learn about that are producing really wholesome animal products.
We are slowly changing the way we eat. You know, it occurs to me that perhaps, Fred, that we should be like your animal friends when we eat. We should approach each new thing with a huge degree of skepticism and wonder.
Yes, I think so, you know, and realization too, Michael. What strikes me about this is how our palate link us with environmental health.
And there it is.
Well,
we're out of time, Fred. But Fred Provenza, thank you so much for joining us. Nourishment, pick it up, folks.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.